All right. Good morning, everybody. Good morning, all you magnificent melon heads of the world. Happy Tuesday, everybody. Today is October 21st, 2025, and our top story this morning. Precious metals, gold and silver, are getting slammed, demolished, crushed, clobbered. They are way down. Mr. Slammy is in the driver's seat. Is this the end of the precious metals rally? Are we going back to the doldrums where we were for the last few years? No, I don't think so. This is pretty much expected. Could this be the top? Maybe. Gold and silver had a hell of a run. But look, guys, things ran way far, way fast. The RSI for gold, ridiculous highs, as high as 87% or 87. We're going to look at some of the things on the chart, some of the reasons why, okay, this pullback makes sense. And then we're going to talk about a whole lot of reasons why this pullback probably is not the end. But we also had a whole bunch of shares of SLV were created yesterday. Shout out to my friend Bob Coleman from Profits Plus ID, who posted yesterday 9.65 million shares of SLV were created. That represents 8.7 million ounces of silver being delivered on the to the LBMA or to the ETF at the LBMA vault. So look, those millions of shares immediately became available to short the SLV, and looks like that's exactly what people did. The cost to borrow those shares went down significantly, still pretty high though, still really high historically. That also means that's what did we say, 8.7 million shares? That's metal that is no longer available in the vaults for other purposes. So the tightness in the market at the LBMA hasn't changed at all. This is really a technical pullback, the more I think about it, and I'm really not sweating this. It's another reason why I continually warn people, be careful on leverage. When things go vertical like this, they tend to get volatile. But overall, I'm really not sweating it all that much. I'm just going to ride this one out and see what happens. Now, we've also got another interesting development in the commodity space. We've got oil on the water. This is something we talked about. It was about 2 weeks ago this story came across my desk. It's in Bloomberg again this morning. Almost 1.2 billion barrels of oil are sitting in tankers on the water right now. That is the highest since 2020. Was the only other time we've had more oil sitting in tankers on the water. And of course, in 2020, oil prices, you may recall, they went low, they kept going, they got to zero, and they kept going. They went deeply negative. Not that that's going to happen now, but this is another strong indicator of an oversupplied market. OPEC Plus is continuing to produce more oil. It really looks like oil prices are heading sharply lower here. Meanwhile, we've got earnings season is underway. And earnings are looking really good this morning. We've had a pretty strong earnings season, right? We had big banks did really well. Some of the regional banks, not so well. There was a lot of weakness in credit markets. That is showing elsewhere this morning as well. But let's talk about some of the earnings first. We had General Motors came out with a beat and raise. Revenue down 1% year over year really wasn't that good, to be honest with you. But they did raise their guidance by a decent clip, and the market is really liking that big raise on their guidance. That stock is up big this morning. Also worth pointing out, though, that their adjusted earnings conveniently overlooks a $1.6 billion charge tied to their misguided investments in electric vehicles. If you take away that $1.6 billion charge, their net income is actually down 57% year over year. But we adjusted the earnings. Don't worry. We adjusted them, and they look great. And, of course, the market is loving that raise here. We also got earnings from GE Aerospace. They have raised their outlook as well. That stock is up this morning. That's a story about Boeing's recovery, right? 2024 was just a dreadful year for Boeing. They did everything you could possibly do wrong, up to and including killing people in 2024. Most of that is now behind Boeing, and so they're starting to ramp up their production again. Airbus is doing the same thing. That is very good for a company like GE Aerospace, whose bread and butter is making jet engines. That's reflected in the earnings this morning. We got a beat and raise from Raytheon as well. Their revenue was up 12%. That is things that make you go boom, doing really well for Raytheon. That's reflective of government deficit spending and the march to World War III. Coca-Cola earnings came out. Their revenue was up. They beat and raised as well. Net sales up 5%, but unit case volume only up 1%. That's interesting. How does that make sense? Oh, yeah, that's right. Higher prices. That's why Coke's earnings were really good, raising the prices there. Also, a little bit of shrinkflation. Some of their smaller volume offerings are doing pretty well. On the geopolitical front or overseas, we had Japan swore in their new prime minister, Takaichi, the first female prime minister in the history of Japan. And her first cabinet meeting, she wants to talk about stimulus. All right, we're going to fire those money printers right up. And we wonder why the yen is weakening against the dollar. We also got French stocks at all-time highs this morning. Keep in mind, guys, it was just yesterday we were talking about how the biggest bank in France was getting demolished by this settlement and how the French government had their credit rating cut for the second time in a month by S&P after Fitch did the same thing. And then this morning, French stocks are at all-time highs. Reasons why I am not sweating the collapse in gold prices this morning for 1,000, Alex. Yeah, French stocks, all-time highs, just after a credit rating downgrade. Gotta love it. We've also got international investors are pulling their money from Chinese real estate. You know, how many times have we seen somebody try to call a bottom in Chinese real estate over the last 4 or 5 years? Well, they're trying again this morning, even though people now realize they're pretty much trapped. Interesting soundbite also, more than 20% of Chinese real estate transactions last year were distressed transactions, meaning they involved some kind of delinquency, default, or foreclosure. 1 in 5 properties that changed hands involved distressed transactions. That is mind-boggling how bad the real estate market in China is. We've also got in the U.S. here, severe credit card delinquencies are at a 14-year high. The last time they were this high was 2011. That's another indicator of the struggling consumer. And is it any coincidence that investors are now pulling their cash from CLO ETFs at the fastest rate since the April Liberation Day panic? CLO, that is collateralized loan obligations, i.e. dog shit corporate debt from zombie companies. When you put all that stuff into an ETF, sell it to investors, then you have Tricolor, then you have First Brands, throw in a little Primalend on top of that. Market starts to get worried. People start pulling their money out of credit funds. And there's one mutual fund, a closed-end mutual fund, did really bad yesterday. We're going to take a look at that one. What the heck is going on there? Guys, there are problems in the credit market. As much as, you know, people keep telling us every single one of these instances is isolated. Oh, don't worry, it's isolated. There's isolated stuff going on everywhere, apparently. We got really good earnings, and then we have these problems in the credit markets with stocks at all-time highs. One of these things is not like the other. So which one is it? Is it still the most raging bull market ever, or are we teetering on the edge? Well, why don't we shrink my big melon of a head and let's find out, shall we? As always, guys, please hit that like button and that subscribe button for you new guys so you can come back tomorrow because we do this one every morning. So come on back and have your coffee with the melon heads as we go through the world of finance every single morning. Right now, the S&P 500 just barely negative, down an entire 1.5 points or 0.03% lower, pretty much unchanged for the day. The Dow is also flat here, up 2 points, offsetting the 2-point decline in the S&P 500. And the NASDAQ is red as well, down 18 points. So stocks are doing a whole bunch of nothing this morning. Meanwhile, we've got the U.S. dollar is stronger at 98.92. That is up by 29 basis points. The yen is driving a lot of that this morning. The new prime minister wanting to get right into the stimmies. We're going to look at that a little bit later on in the show. And looking over at the bond market, we got yields are modestly lower once again this morning. The 30-year Treasury, 4.548. That's off by 3 basis points. The 10-year yield is at 3.957, down almost 3 basis points. The 2-year is at 3.449. That's down 1.5 this morning. And the 1-month at 4.014. That's off by 3 basis points as the market begins to price in the near certainty of the Fed cutting rates. Is that later this week that that happens? When is the next FOMC? I should know that off the top of my head. Let's look at the CME Fed watch tool real quick. I should have that up, but I don't. Let's see. The next FOMC, October 29th. So, okay, not this week. It's next week. But again, you can see here a 96.7% likelihood that they cut at the October meeting. All right, where were we? We were on the bond market. Let's look at Bitcoin real quick before we do the rest of the commodities. Down about 2,000 this morning, 108 or 108,520-ish. as priced on Coinbase, down about 2,000, offsetting yesterday's gains pretty much back to where we were Sunday. Again, guys, be careful on leverage when dealing with crypto. And looking over at the commodities board, here's the bludgeoning that's happening in metals. We're pretty much at the lows of the morning here. We've got spot gold, first of all, $4,196. That's off by $160 this morning, 3.7% lower for spot gold. We hit an intra-morning high of 43.75, quite a wild trading range here. The December gold futures, the New York price, if you will, $4,209. That's off by $150 or 3.4% lower after hitting an intraday high of $4,393. We didn't quite hit that $4,400 level before this pullback started. Silver is looking even worse, starting with the London spot price, $49.77. We have given up that $50 mark, down $2.64, over 5% lower after hitting an intraday high of $52.67. Just crazy volatility in silver this morning. The New York price not faring any better here, $48.80 for December silver futures. That's down by about 2.55%. I'm sorry, $2.55, or about 5% lower. But you know what? Even with all this red, I still like the shiny. We're going to look at a couple more things just as soon as I get through the other commodities here. We got copper down about 1.1%, platinum down 5.7%, palladium down 6.3%. All of the metallic commodities are deep in the red this morning. Crude oil, though, pretty much flat here, up a couple of cents, $57.04 for December WTI futures. Put a pin in oil. We'll be back to that in just a minute. But we got this one in Bloomberg this morning. Gold and silver slump as traders take stock of record rallies. Gold and silver slid as traders took stock. That's the second time they said that, of record rallies, with technical indicators looking stretched while U.S.-China tensions ease. You know, there is a lot of optimism about these U.S.-China tensions easing. Okay, Trump and Xi are going to have a meeting, and they're being rather belligerent pricks to each other in the lead-up to that meeting. I don't know if I would call that tensions easing or not, but again, the relentless optimism of this market. Okay, the tensions have eased a little bit. Bullion fell by as much as 2.6% after hitting a fresh peak of 43.81 an ounce on Monday. Gold's ferocious rally has measures like relative strength indicating that prices have passed well into overbought territory. A strengthening U.S. dollar has also made precious metals more expensive for most buyers, and silver plummeted as much as 6.2%. In the last couple of trading sessions, traders have increasingly been looking over their shoulders as concerns about a correction and consolidation have arisen, said Ola Hansen, commodity strategist at Saxo Bank. It's during corrections that a market's true strength is revealed, and this time should be no different, with an underlying bid likely keeping any pullback limited. So, you know, Bloomberg's taking a stab at this sell-off and basically saying it's technical driven. It ran too far, too fast. There's no underlying weakness in the market that's causing this. There's no like big sudden policy change or big geopolitical story driving this sell-off. People just decided it was time to take some profits. Now, you can see on the chart here, we're looking at daily candles, obviously big red candle here following a little bit of volatility Friday and yesterday. Gold had retaken the highs before Friday's sell-off this morning, though, given those back. Now, the other thing I want to draw your attention to here is this one, the relative strength index, or the RSI. And this is what Bloomberg was talking about. Anything generally approaching 70, anything in the 60s is considered overbought. Anything above 70 is considered ridiculously overbought. And you can see we've been over 70 for what? For almost 2 months now. The RSI has been over 70 during this relentless run-up in gold. So it was just due for a pullback, guys. Nothing goes up in a straight line forever. Give this RSI time to work out. We've been here before. Like, let's zoom out a little bit, right? We were in overbought territory here, 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 here. Each time gold continued to grind higher over the last 2 years. So an RSI over 70 is not a death sentence. It just means we're pulling back this morning. And I want to send a shout out to my friend Bob Coleman at Profits Plus ID on X, who posted this one yesterday late in the day. 9.65 million shares created. This is an SLV ETF alert. That 9.65 million shares represents over 8.7 million ounces delivered into the SLV, a new high for the year in shares outstanding and silver held. All right, so every time people pile into the SLV ETF, they bid up the price of the stock, of the share of the ETF, but there's still only X amount of metal in that fund. If the share price gets so far above that it starts trading at a big premium to net asset value, they issue new shares. That dilution brings the share price back down towards net asset value. And with the proceeds of issuing those new shares, they go buy the underlying metal. That's one way that SLV, that the ETF can affect the price of the underlying metal. So you had a ton of metal got bought yesterday by the SLV ETF. Now, how does that equal a pullback? Well, one possible mechanism is we're looking right here at the silver, the SLV ETF shares available to borrow. Now, yesterday we went as high as 20.6% to borrow shares of the SLV in order to short it. Now, right now we are at 16.25%, so that price is down, and all of a sudden there are 2.7 million shares available to borrow at that price. So you can see that the SLV ETF, they issue a bunch of shares, they buy the metal, but all of a sudden there's millions of shares available if you want to go short the ETF. The shorts are doing just that. 2.7 of those 9.6 million new shares are now out there available in order to short this thing. Still, though, 16.25%, very expensive cost to borrow there. I would even say highly prohibitive, but way down from the highs we saw yesterday. Guys, the market's just very volatile here. The fact that there's still so much metal being bought up by these ETFs tells me the underlying tightness in London is unchanged. Meanwhile, the oil's long-awaited surplus arrives on a billion-barrel flotilla. Who had billion-barrel flotilla on their 2020s bingo card? The best place to observe the shift taking place in global oil markets is at sea. More than 1 billion barrels have been amassed on the world's tanker fleet, according to consultant Vortexa LTD. It's the biggest flotilla of oil on the water since 2020, when a price war between Saudi Arabia and Russia flooded the market during the COVID-19 pandemic. The phenomenon gives tangible support to long-held predictions that surging production will push the market into surplus, while China has kept the excess hidden for months by scooping up cheap barrels for its strategic reserves. The market finally seems to have reached a tipping point. The scale of projected oversupply started to swell in April when Saudi Arabia and its partners in the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries said that we'd begin reviving idle oil production far faster than scheduled. Riyadh's objective, officials say privately, was to recoup its lost share of world markets. World inventories have been accumulating at a rate of 1.9 million barrels a day so far this year, according to the IEA. The surge in barrels at sea could be the precursors to an even bigger buildup in 2026. That is in large part due to the accelerated unwinding of extra voluntary production cuts agreed in 2023 by 8 OPEC plus countries. The outlook for non-OPEC plus supply growth has also marginally increased, i.e. the U.S. is pumping more oil. Guyana is expected to pump more oil. Those hefty increases are set against a backdrop of tepid demand growth. And I would add that tepid demand growth also includes Chinese overproduction capacity, or production capacity, oversupply, overcapacity, whatever you want to say. The oil market is oversupplied here, guys, and it looks like oil prices are headed lower. All right. Meanwhile, let's talk about some of these earnings that came out. They were all pretty good. First with GM, raised their guidance, beating Wall Street expectations, and lowering tariff costs. That's interesting. Detroit General Motors raised its 2025 financial guidance Tuesday after beating Wall Street's top and bottom line earnings expectations for the third quarter while lowering its expected impact from tariffs. Shares of GM swung from down 2.4% to up more than 9% during pre-market trading Tuesday. Pretty volatile here. EPS was $2.80. versus 231 expected. That's a big beat. Revenue 48.59 billion versus 45.27 expected. Adjusted EBIT 338 versus 272. That is a big beat for GM. Now, their third quarter revenue of 48.59 billion was down less than 1% from 48.76 billion in the same period. So you can see there, all right, they beat revenue. They beat by a big margin, but it was down 1% from a year ago. So sales is heading in the wrong direction. but GM's new outlook signals strength for the automaker heading into the fourth quarter and beats Wall Street analysts' current expectations for the last 3 months of the year. The updated guidance includes earnings before interest and taxes of between $12 and $13 billion, or $9.75 to $10.50 a share. That's up from $10 to $12.5 billion, or $8.25 to $10 a share. So let's see, they're raising the lower, they're raising both ends. It's a pretty big raise here for their EBIT. They're also raising their free cash flow guidance. Now, one interesting thing with GM's results is they do not include the $1.6 billion in special charges reported by the automaker last week due to its pullback in all-electric vehicles, which more than halved its net income attributable to stockholders compared with the third quarter of 2024. The company's net income was $1.3 billion during the just reported period, down 57% from roughly $3.1 billion a year ago. So yeah, as long as we include that one bonehead decision about electric vehicles that cost us half our earnings, take that out of the equation. It was a really good quarter. Market seems to have moved right past that EV charge. They're looking instead on that big raise in their guidance. GM shares are ripping ahead of the opening bell, up 9.3%, trading at $63.45. That's after already rising 8.8% year to date. That 9% gain this morning is on top of that. So GM shares are looking pretty good here, despite the worries about automotive finance. And GE Aerospace also raised their outlook a second time on aviation rebound. General Electric raised its full-year outlook for a second consecutive quarter as the jet engine manufacturer cashes in on strong air travel demand. Adjusted earnings will be $6 to $6.20 a share, up from the prior range of $5.60 to $5.80 a share, the company said in a statement on Tuesday. Analysts had expected $5.92 on average. GE, which does business as GE Aerospace, also raised its forecast for adjusted revenue growth to the high teens from the mid-teens, as well as for operating profit and free cash flow. The results underscore how the company continues to gain momentum after CEO Larry Culp completed a three-way split of the longtime conglomerate last year. GE shares have soared as revenue and profit grew across the business, despite challenges from tariffs and supply chain turmoil that have hampered other aerospace manufacturers. The company's maintenance and repair business is also helping GE overcome higher costs associated with the rise in new engine deliveries to fulfill growing airplane production at Boeing and Airbus. Newly built turbines are often sold at a loss before harvesting earnings over several years through maintenance agreements. Operating profit will be $8.65 billion to $8.85 billion this year, up from a previous guidance of $8.5 billion, while free cash flow will be $7.1 to $7.3 billion. It previously guided for a range of $6.5 to $6.9 billion. So beat and raise for GE Aerospace. That stock is higher as well this morning, up 2.25%, $309.62. As things get better at Boeing, things get better at Boeing's suppliers. Meanwhile, Raytheon, also a beat and raise. They raised their outlook on higher quarterly profit. Revenue rose 12% to $22.5 billion. It's not hard to imagine what's going on here, guys. We're building a lot of missiles. We're firing a lot of missiles. And Raytheon is collecting as a result of it. Revenue rose 12% to $22.5 billion, beating Wall Street predictions of $21.3 billion. RTX said it received $37 billion in new awards in the third quarter. The company raised its full-year adjusted earnings guidance to $6.10 to $6.20 a share, up from a previous range of $5.80 to $5.95 a share. Analysts see full-year adjusted earnings of $5.95. Raytheon shares also ripping this morning, up 7%, $172.02. So earnings looking pretty good this morning, right? All of those were pretty good. We got one more to get through. Coca-Cola tops earnings and revenue estimates, but says demand for drinks is still soft. And Coca-Cola is probably the one, I don't want to say a weak spot because the earnings were okay, probably better than expected. But there's some things here that don't look so good for Coke's earnings. Coca-Cola reported quarterly earnings and revenue that topped expectations, but the beverage giant said that demand for its drinks is still soft. EPS of 82 cents versus 78 cents expected, so it's a beat. Revenue, 12.41 billion versus 12.39, beat on the top and on the bottom. Net sales rose 5% to $12.46 billion. Coke's organic revenue, which strips out acquisitions, divestitures, and foreign currency, increased 6%. Shares were up nearly 3% in pre-market trading. The company's unit case volume rose 1%, a reversal from last quarter's decline. The metric excludes the impact of pricing and foreign currency to reflect demand. So right there, you can see you got net sales are up 5%, even though case volumes were only up 1%. That is price hikes. They raised their prices, and so they made more money. Consumers so far are eating that, but not really. But volume in both Latin America and North America, two key markets, was flat for the quarter. Coke executives have previously said that low-income consumers in the U.S. have been buying fewer of its products, although the company is trying to target them with affordable options. So Coke is having to walk that fine line. They are raising their prices. If they raise them any more aggressively, they'll start to see shrinking volumes in the all-important North American market. But so far, they're doing a good job walking that fine line. They're also offering a lot of smaller shrinkflation options as well. Coca-Cola shares, the opening bell has rung up 3.25% here, $70.75, up by $2.25 this morning. Meanwhile, we've got some global stories going on this morning. Japan's Takaichi to order stimulus package. Kyoto reports, well, and why not? She's been prime minister for almost 4 hours now. Why not start up the money printers? Japan's prime minister, Sanae Takaichi, will instruct her cabinet to draft a stimulus package to tackle inflation at her first cabinet meeting on Tuesday night, Kyoto news agency reported. Guys, that's not how that works. A stimulus package to tackle inflation. That is not how that works. Stimulus causes inflation. It doesn't tackle it. Okay. All right. When you pick somebody up and march them down the field and drop them in their own end zone, that doesn't count as a tackle. John Madden, help me out here. All right. But the package will include expanded local government subsidies and gasoline tax cuts, with plans to submit a supplementary budget to the parliament, Kyoto reported without citing sources. So, nothing about helicopter money here. Local government subsidies, that's like kind of helicopter money. It depends what they spend it on. Gasoline tax cuts, sure, why not? But guys, stimulus is not how you fix inflation. And well, maybe that's why the Japanese yen is falling once again this morning. USD JPY, remember this chart, going higher means the Japanese yen is weakening against the dollar. It now takes 151.78 yen to make $1. It was 152 earlier this morning. Since Takaichi has been announced as the likely successor to lead Japan to be the new prime minister, we have seen the Japanese yen weaken rather substantially here. That's also contributing to the higher Dixie this morning, which is also contributing to the lower gold price this morning. But if you're worried about gold's price, look at this one. French stocks hit record high as earnings counter debt concerns. All right, didn't we just talk yesterday about how the French government had their credit rating cut because Lecornu survived his no-confidence vote because they cut a deal with the socialists where they're not going to raise the retirement age? In other words, more government debt spending make the fiscal problems worse. And so S&P cuts their credit outlook. And then a day later, stocks hit all-time highs. This is a melt-up that we're seeing happening here. And this is why I am not worried about this pullback in gold. When I see headlines like this, after headlines like we talked about in France yesterday, all right, they're all spinning up the money printer. The Japanese are doing it. The French are doing it. We're going to do it. There's just not enough gold in the whole world. And if gold wants to go on sale, then we should oblige it. Meanwhile, a troubled $140 billion bet on China's property gets even worse. Guys, they keep just the things in China, the real estate collapse, it just keeps getting worse. They've been calling a bottom for years. And well, I haven't seen one. Have any of you guys seen one? Many foreign investors are stuck with real estate assets that are increasingly difficult to sell. International investors who poured billions of dollars into China's real estate are increasingly looking to sell their properties at steep losses, threatening more pain for a sector that has weighed heavily on Asia's largest economy. Since late 2024, investment managers, including BlackRock and Carlyle, have offloaded commercial buildings in the country that sold for far less than what they originally paid, causing banks that finance the assets to lose money as well. More global institutions are looking to divest their Chinese properties, said dealmakers and bankers who asked not to be identified because they don't want to disappear in the middle of the night. Foreign property buyers had invested close to $140 billion into office towers, warehouses, shopping malls, and data centers in China in the last 15 years, according to data compiled by MSCI Real Estate. MSCI Real Capital Analytics, I'm sorry. Investors thought they would profit from a long-lasting surge in demand from businesses looking for space, but that turned out to be a miscalculation. An unprecedented supply glut is causing rents to fall and values of many properties to tumble. And look at this statistic here. This blew my mind. Distressed sales of China's commercial real estate assets totaled 114 billion yuan, or $16 billion over 2023 and 2024. That made up a record 22% of total transactions last year, according to a report by Bloomberg Intelligence. More than one in five commercial real estate transactions in China involve some form of distress. A distress sale occurs when there is a loan default or when a seller loses control of an asset. That means the Chinese market is a mess. The problem is now the longer property owners wait to sell out, the bigger their losses are likely to become. Capital values are the estimated market values of Beijing and Shanghai offices, which make up a large chunk of foreigners' real estate purchases, have plunged at least 40% from 2019, according to investors and bankers actively involved in the deals. So who wants to call a bottom in Chinese real estate today? Anybody? Not I, said Jack. Meanwhile, here stateside, we've got our own credit problems, our own debt problems. Serious credit card delinquencies hit a 14-year high. And then, yeah, they're making some stock recommendations based on that. Recent data from New York Federal Reserve Bank and Equifax highlighted a troubling trend in U.S. consumer finances. Credit card accounts that are 90 days delinquent reached 12.27% in the second quarter, just 1.4 percentage points below the all-time high of 13.7% recorded in the second quarter of 2011, marking a 14-year peak. While there may be slight improvement from the 12.31% recorded in Q1, a sharp increase from 10.93% a year ago underscores a deteriorating financial picture. The situation is compounded by other serious delinquencies, 5% of auto loans, and a staggering 10.2% of student loan debt. That student loan debt number is going to get much bigger. A lot of that still isn't getting reported. That likely exacerbated by the resumption of repayments are also on the rise. I would also say not included here is buy now, pay later debt, which we know a huge number of people are delinquent on that as well. These trends suggest the U.S. consumer is increasingly financially strained. Investors need to tread carefully in this potential minefield. And then they go on to list a couple of stocks that they like. Yeah, okay, they're telling people buy Visa. Okay, yeah, credit card debt is going bad. Delinquencies are up and they say buy Visa. I'm going to stop reading right there because let's just stop. Why don't we leave that one alone, shall we? Now, look, as the consumer debt is bad, I am convinced that that actually is playing a role in this one. Investors pull cash from CLO ETFs in the biggest outflow since April. CLO is a collateralized loan obligation, basically risky debt, guys. Risky corporate debt is what a CLO is. You take enough of that, you put it in a box, you write ETF on it, and then you can sell it to retail investors. Exchange-traded funds that hold bundles of corporate loans last week notched their first outflow since April in the latest sign that investor concern over credit quality are mounting. ETFs of collateralized loan obligations experienced an outflow of about $516 million last week, marking the first investor exodus in about 6 months. Analysts at JP Morgan, led by Rashad Aluwalia, wrote in a Monday report, that compares to a weekly average of about $421 million of inflows over the past year. Credit investors have turned more cautious after the implosions of auto lender Tricolor Holdings and car parts supplier First Brand Group. Last week, JP Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon raised the alarm over the potential of more than one cockroach, warning that certain corners of credit markets might see outsized losses if the economy sours. Banking shares also took a hit after two U.S. regional banks unexpectedly disclosed loan losses on suspected fraud. That was Western Alliance and Zions Bank. We talked about that one late last week. Leading the weekly outflows was the $25 billion Janus Henderson AAA CLO ETF, which invests in the highest rated type of CLO bonds and had about $476 million of withdrawals. That's the most redemptions since tariff-induced volatility in April, sparked record outflows. So we've got retail investors getting a little cautious about these corporate debt ETFs. That's not surprising. Take this one, for example. This one, some of my friends over at MacroEdge pointed this one out yesterday. The Guggenheim Strategic Opportunities Fund. This thing fell about 9% yesterday. All right. It's up 2.25% this morning, bouncing a little bit off of those lows, but down almost 14% over the last month. And then look at this big red candle yesterday. I don't know what that was, but somebody saw something they didn't like in this Guggenheim Strategic Opportunities Fund, ticker GOF. But I just did a little bit of cursory. The fund's co-managed by Guggenheim Partners, invests in public equity and fixed income markets across the globe. I don't know. I'm guessing it's the fixed income. Some of the corporate debt holdings in this thing probably took a dive. Maybe that's First Brands and Tricolor related, or maybe there's something else going on there. I don't know. But these strategic opportunities funds, CLO ETFs, private credit, all this dog shit debt that has been packaged up and sold to retail investors. Ever since that Tricolor bankruptcy, you can see everybody's got their guard up. They're starting to play defense. And if the banks are nervous about this and the banks stop lending to companies like those held in the Guggenheim Strategic Opportunities Fund, then they're not going to be able to refinance that debt, or they're going to have to pay even more money to do so, which would mean those shares would not do so well. So if credit conditions continue to dry up here, they're going to have big problems in funds like this. Just be careful what you're holding, guys. Keep saying that. Just know what you own. Steve Wojtas, thank you, sir, very much for supporting the channel. He says, I see USA 10-year bond yield is under 4% again and trending down. What are these low yields telling us about the current macro situation? Well, look, a couple of things to note about the 10-year. The Federal Reserve is still adding 10-year bonds to its portfolio. Even though the Fed tells us they're doing quantitative tightening, the Federal Reserve has been increasing their holdings of 10s, 20s, and 30s this whole time they've been tightening. So we still don't really have true free market price discovery on the long end of the U.S. yield curve. There's some. The Fed doesn't directly control it, but they are influencing it, and their Fed is still a buyer, all right? So they're suppressing those yields somewhat. At the same time, the 10-year is typically viewed as a safe haven asset, less so than it used to be. But we saw with that big Friday sell-off on the China tariff news 2 weeks ago that the 10-year is still a place people will run to for safety. So as that is trending lower, maybe some of this risk that's building up in credit markets, the Tricolor, the First Brands thing, that's driving some people to the 10-year. So generally, I see that as something of a risk off. Now, that's contrary to what we're seeing in stocks, which just continue to make stupid high after stupid high. But that's kind of what I see. Also, a little bit of front running. Everybody expects the Fed to lower again in October. They're probably going to lower again in December after that. Lower rates are here to stay. And I would also add that the 10-year yield falling, that's also one of the reasons why gold has done so well, because the 10-year competes with gold. So as the 10-year yield moves lower, gold looks better and better. Of course, as gold moves higher and higher, that makes the 10-year look better and better. They kind of compete with each other. So these two markets are intertwined here. But generally, I think it reflects the prospects of the money printer spinning back up again and the safe haven qualities of the 10-year yield. Thank you, Steve, for supporting the channel, sir. Hunt and Cover, good to see you, sir. He says, we can't have a repeat of yesterday. Show our head melon some love. Thank you for your work, Jack. I appreciate that very much, Hunt and Cover. Good to see you again, sir. I'm glad you're doing better. Thank you so much for the generosity and the good vibes. And while we are on the subject, I want to send a special shout out to my girl, Nan. Nan, it's good to have you back in the chat with us this morning. So glad to see you. Hope you feel better soon. Thank you very much, Hunt and Cover, for supporting the channel. Madison Hype says, utility stocks are trading like growth. Pullback? Utility stocks. Now, let's talk about those. Historically, utility stocks have been one of those almost safe haven assets. Not quite. The utility stocks have been viewed as a bond market alternative. Boring, yield-bearing stocks that are almost like bonds. They're not sexy. They're not fun. They're just safe yield. All right, kind of like treasury bonds. Yawn, put me to sleep, bore me. Ever since this ridiculous AI bubble, utility stocks have started to trade like meme stocks, up 80% year over year, some of these names. Utilities are not a safe haven right now. That is important. All right, if you're looking at the low yield, if you're looking at gold and saying it looks a little overpricey maybe, and you're like, all right, maybe I'll look at utility stocks. Understand, if you're in utility stocks right now, you are in the AI bubble. That's what utility stocks are right now. Utilities are not supposed to rise 80 to 90% in a year. And shout out to my friend Pasta Man. He sent me a video on another channel. I can't remember the name of it recently, but it was a video about this. Was it 1866? This big market collapse. And one of the sound bites from that video that really stuck with me is, when boring things get excited, run. All right. Boring things need to stay boring. When boring companies, when boring markets get really exciting and really interesting, that means something is out of whack and something is about to break. All right. So utilities trading like growth names, dead giveaway that this market is frothy. Great question, Madison. Thank you so much for supporting the channel. And yes, way overdue for a pullback. Metal Seer, thank you, sir, for supporting the channels. Metal says we'll be back. I agree. Look, this pullback, maybe it trades sideways for a couple of months. Maybe this pullback lasts a couple of days. I don't care. When I buy physical metal, I've mentioned this a couple of times, this is a savings vehicle, not a speculative bet or anything like that. It's not a levered trade on anything. All right. Now, be careful if you're on leverage, if you're playing options in some of the ETFs or mining stocks, all right? If you go too far out on leverage, a pullback like this can wipe you out. So be careful there. But other than that, I'm really not worried about this pullback, guys. I'm just not. All the reasons pushing metals higher are still in effect. Thank you very much, Metal Seer, for supporting the channel. Learcy, what's going on? Learcy says, Ari, the AU, a gold run, getting all periodic on my table here, says, insiders know something big is coming. Yeah, I think so. I think, generally speaking, my view on gold, a lot of people are saying it's the Chinese central bank buying up. And yeah, that's playing a role as well. And the Indian Diwali Festival played a role too. But stateside here, I think people are starting to realize that negative real yields is going to be a thing. It's the only way the government can continue to pay for its ridiculous, reckless, irresponsible behavior. And so if the yield on bonds is not going to keep up with inflation, then you need to find another place to park your boring money. The traditional 60 portfolio doesn't work anymore. Stocks are in a bubble and bonds are negative real yielding. So you better start looking at gold. And we've had guys like Dalio and Gundlach have come out in recent days suggesting a historically very high allocation to gold, 15 to 25%. Those were the numbers those two names used. That's a lot of money flowing in the gold markets. And so do insiders know something big is coming? Honestly, at this point, I think outsiders know something big is coming too. It's not really a secret anymore, Learcy. But yeah, I think that's also contributing to the sharp rise in gold. And again, when gold doubles over a span of a year, you can expect a pullback of $100 or even $200. It's going to be interesting. But as always, guys, just be careful on leverage. And guys, I want to say thank you very much for having your coffee with the Melonheads this morning. Don't forget that like button and that subscribe button for the algorithm. Pretty please, with a cherry on top on the way up. Thank you so much for the super chats and supporting the channel. I appreciate the generosity. Welcome back, Nan. Hello, Hunt Cover. Good to see you guys doing well. Also, thank you to my magnanimous Melonheads on Patreon and YouTube members. Thank you guys so much for supporting the channel. Links down below should you feel so inclined. Hi, Mom. Hi, Dad. Love you guys. Everybody, till next time, live small and dream big.